From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. When asked why he'd never written a novel as good as Catch-22, Joseph Heller replied, "Who has?" 50 years after its publication, the anti-war classic is still part of the American lexicon. Heller based the book on his own experience flying missions over France in World War II. The son of Russian immigrants grew up on Coney Island. He went on to write seven novels. Heller died in 1999, shortly before publication of his final book, Portrait of an Artist as an Old Man. The life and work of Joseph Heller, first the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The rare October snowstorm that slammed the Northeast over the weekend has created headaches for commuters and travelers today and for more than 2 million homes and businesses still without electricity. Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy says people are going to have to be patient.
We're talking about the long-term loss of energy up to a week in large swaths of the state.
There are also widespread outages in New Jersey, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire. In New York's Central Park, as many as 1,000 trees may be lost because of damage from the heavy snow. President Obama is slated to sign early this afternoon an executive order directing the Food and Drug Administration to take steps to reduce prescription drug shortages. The White House says those shortages have endangered some patients and have raised concerns about possible price gouging. The order is the latest in a series of initiatives by the president that do not require congressional approval. House Speaker John Boehner insists GOP lawmakers are willing to look for common ground with Democrats on issues regarding jobs and the economy.
Common ground doesn't mean compromising on your principles. A common ground means finding places where your agenda overlaps with that of the other party, locking arms and getting it done.
Today wraps up an October that has been a fairly encouraging month for the U.S. economy. The stock market has rallied. Economic growth numbers were decent. Even consumer spending has perked up some. But NPR's Robert Smith with the Planet Money team in New York tells us that on this Halloween, there are still a few scary numbers out there.
The numbers you cited, look, they go up and down and up and down. So for me, a number, if a number's truly scary and frightening, it goes down and it stays down and it threatens to stay down for years. So clearly the two biggest drags on the economy right now are housing and unemployment. And they both share this thing we call stickiness. Like, no one wants to hire somebody and then fire them the next week. And it's the same way with housing. There are millions of homes stuck in foreclosure that goes on for 2 years. So both housing and unemployment are the things that are going to take years to sort out.
You mentioned unemployment. At the end of this week, we'll see the new figures on joblessness. What's scary there?
Well, it's just the sheer number of jobs that this economy has to make up. You know, I was doing the math this morning. The U.S. lost 8.7 million jobs since the beginning of the recession. The economy recovered about 2.09 million of them. So the scariest number is the hole we're in. 6.66 million jobs. Yeah, 666. 6.6 million jobs need to be created just to return to where we were.
That's Robert Smith with NPR's Planet Money team in New York. St. Louis Cardinals manager Tony La Russa has announced his retirement 3 days after the Cards downed the Texas Rangers to win the World Series. It was the third World Series championship for the 67-year-old La Russa. Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is down 133 points. The Nasdaq is off 28. This is NPR News from Washington. Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain has avoided answering questions this morning about sexual harassment allegations made against him in the 1990s. NPR's Tamara Keith has the story.
The event was billed as a discussion with Herman Cain about his 999 tax plan, and Cain and the moderator did their very best to stay on topic. An article posted on the Politico website last night said two women accused Cain of inappropriate behavior back in the 90s when he was the head of the National Restaurant Association. When someone in the audience attempted to ask about it, his microphone was shut off.
He's going to be at the press club today.
I'm going by the ground rules that my host have set.
Cain said he would take all of the arrows later. His campaign is calling the charges thinly sourced and implied he was being targeted by liberals who disagree with his politics. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
Qantas Airlines planes are back in the air today after an arbitration court put an end to the airline's long-running dispute with its employees. The BBC's Phil Mercer in Sydney says getting tens of thousands of stranded passengers to their destinations will take time.
Qantas flights are resuming after the most extraordinary episode in which the entire fleet was grounded. The airline claims that unreasonable demands over pay and restructuring by the trade unions left it with no choice, but critics say it was a maniacal overreaction. Clearing a huge backlog of tired and frustrated passengers will be an immense logistical challenge. Some travellers have vowed never again to fly Qantas. Its reputation may have been damaged, but its share price rose by more than 6% in early trading.
That's the BBC's Phil Mercer. And I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Foundation for Islamic Art, seeking to improve Americans' understanding of Muslim arts and cultures.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. Joseph Heller is best known as the author of Catch-22, regarded as one of the finest books in American literature. The title is also a permanent part of our lexicon, but despite the fact he was defined by it, Heller did not consider the book to be his best. On the 50th anniversary of the publication of the anti-war novel, two new biographies are out on Joseph Heller. One is by his daughter, Erica. She'll join us later in the show. But first, joining me in the studio is Tracy Daugherty. He's the author of Just One Catch. I know many of you are fans, perhaps even critics, of Joseph Heller. I invite you to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or Twitter. Tracy Daugherty's book is titled Just One Catch. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here, Tracy. You use a quote at the start of the book. Read that for us, would you?
In 1975, Joseph Heller said, "It is impossible to predict or control how you will be remembered after your death. In that way, dying is like having children. You never know what will come out." In Beckett's Endgame, he asks his parents, in effect, "Why did you have me?" And the father replies, "We didn't know it would be you."
Why did you choose that particular quote?
The novel that you referenced in your introduction that Heller felt was his best was a novel called Something Happened, which he published in 1974. And it is a very autobiographical novel about a man working as an advertising business person and his family. And as he puts it in the novel, his unhappy wife and his unhappy children. And so it's a very eviscerating portrait of family life. And I do think his family, and Erica can address this when she joins us, was made quite unhappy by it. So the whole idea of family and how family will remember you was very much on his mind.
Interesting. Why has Catch-22 endured so long, 50 years for this book?
It is, as you said, an anti-war novel, but I think it's much more than that. And I think a couple of reasons why it has endured. Unfortunately, war continues to be a timely topic, so the book continues to be timely. But the satire is really beyond war, and really he goes after bureaucratic institutions and the absurdities that we all get trapped in, the rules and the counter-rules that keep us all paralyzed in whatever institution we find ourselves in. And over time, of course, our institutions and bureaucracies have become only more bloated.
But how did the critics receive it?
The book got very mixed reviews upon its initial publication, and some very harsh ones, in fact. And so it did not gain traction for several years. And really, it was because the Vietnam War heated up in the mid to late 60s. And the book, even though it was set in World War II, came to be seen as prophetic of what was happening in Vietnam and then was taken up as a cult book.
And, of course, Joseph Heller himself was a bombardier in World War II. He witnessed some pretty awful stuff. And out of that came Catch-22.
It did. He flew 60 bombing missions, and statistically the chances of surviving that many missions was pretty nearly zero. So he managed to escape that and then 20 years later get this book out of it. One of the myths, though, about Heller and Catch-22 that I try to debunk is that many people feel the war is what created his cynicism and his irony and his attitude toward absurdity.
It was there early.
But I think that that sensibility was fixed quite early from his very strange childhood in Coney Island, and the war just solidified it.
Tell me about that strange upbringing in Coney Island.
Well, Coney was a very baffling place to begin with. It was full of immigrants and different languages. He heard so many different languages on the street every day, even in his own home. His mother spoke very little English. It was a residential area, but also an amusement park. It was supposed to be a place of fun and happiness, but it was quite desperate and dirty in many ways, hard to find jobs. So a lot of conflicting experiences. And within his own family, he did not find out until he was in his teens that his brother and his sister were not really quite his brother and sister. They were stepbrother and stepsister. No one had bothered to tell him this. So his early experiences from childhood through adolescence were filled with contradictions and missing information and gaps. And this, of course, all feeds into the idea of Catch-22.
Tell me about his father, who was early on a really harsh critic.
His father died when Heller was four, and his name was Isaac Heller, a Russian immigrant, and a very demanding man, and also a man who withheld a great deal, as I mentioned. He did not really reveal to his children, and of course didn't have a chance to with Joseph, because he died when Joseph was so young, about the family dynamic. Joseph's older brother did say that the father was quite harsh and a verbal bully of sorts, and so this was part of the family background as well.
Didn't that older brother at one point run away?
He did. He was very much during the Depression. He ran off and hitchhiked west to try to get a job because there was nothing there. And he was also ashamed. He didn't want to face his father without a job. And so, yeah, the family was quite fractured early on.
And after his father died, when Joseph was four, the family had to move to a smaller, much less expensive apartment.
Yes, exactly, yes. And the mother was working as a seamstress. And at that point, Joseph's older brother had to be the breadwinner, essentially. And
how did he do that?
Various odd jobs. He never quite settled, and he did very many things and gave up his dream of going to college, and later then became a bit jealous of Joseph, who, because of the GI Bill, because of the war, one of the fortunate recurrences or occurrences because of the war, Joseph was able to go to college and surpass his brother in that sense. But Joseph, in a sense, was raised by his brother.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Extraordinarily bright was Joseph early on.
Exactly, yes. He outpaced his schoolmates. He was considered a loudmouth and a bit of a bully himself. So he was quite charismatic, wanting attention very early, but also frustrating his teachers because he knew all the answers and intimidated his classmates.
And even if he looked bored, he knew the answer.
He did. He did. He was one of those students that all teachers, and I can speak to this being a teacher, don't know what to do with, because you look at them and you think they're not paying attention. You try to catch them, and in fact, they are paying attention, and he knows everything.
His manner, I gather, from very early on was, shall we say, obstreperous.
Indeed. And one early teacher decided the way to tone him down was to put him in charge. So she left the room one day and said, you're in charge, you make the others behave.
How old was
this
he
is,
at
I think
the
this
time?
Was this was eighth grade. I found this in a letter that one of his classmates wrote him many years later. Remember when you were put in charge of the class, but that was the way to get you to behave and diffuse you.
How really very special. He also, though, was lashing out at his sister, at his mother, at his brother. I mean, he was not easy to get along with.
He was not, and he does say that when he learned that his mother was the stepmother of his brother and sister and that he had not been told the family history, he became angry, and he stifled the emotion, as he put it, but he did take the anger out in other ways. His sister would come home smelling of cigarettes, for example, or she would come home one day having bleached her hair, and he would lash out at her for these things, which he didn't really care about, but that was his way of trying to get back at her for not being intimate with him and not telling him the story.
I interviewed Joseph Heller in February of 1998, shortly after we had moved here to the studios, for his book, Now and Then.
Yes, his memoir.
And what did critics say about that book?
This was the memoir was subtitled From Coney Island to Here. And so this was Joseph Heller telling his full story, supposedly. But most critics felt that the book showed very little self-awareness, that he skimmed the surface of things, he was not very reflective, would not talk very much about the emotional issues in his life. I found in reading the book for my biography and looking for his version of his childhood that he had a very nostalgic take on his childhood, that it almost reads like an old World War II newsreel. It has that kind of amber glow to it, the prose does. So it's a very pleasant book, a very nostalgic book, but in fact, and I do think he honestly remembered his life that way later, but I do think it covered up a lot of the deep pain that he felt.
He had that gruff exterior.
He did, but I think that was also common to men of his generation and his time and place. It was, you didn't show your emotions. You were a tough guy.
One thing that was extraordinarily important to him was money.
Indeed. There's an anecdote during his father's funeral, which he didn't really realize was a funeral. He thought it was a big family party. But at one point, an aunt presses a dollar bill into his hand. And he did say later on that at that moment, money and life and death all became intertwined in his mind. That may be a little bit of revisionist memory, but for him, money was life and lack of money was death.
Tracy Daugherty, he's author and biographer. His biography of Joseph Heller is titled Just One Catch. When we come back, we'll talk to Joseph Heller's daughter, Erica.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Joining us now is Erika Heller. She is the daughter of Joseph Heller. She's the author of a new book. It's titled Yosarian, Slept Here When Joseph Heller Was Dead, The Apthorpe Was Home, and Life Was a Catch-22. Good morning to you, Erika. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
Erika, I'm so interested that you open the book with your mother's deathbed statements after her then ex-husband, Joseph, sent her flowers at the hospital. Tell me about that scene.
Well, it was a very poignant moment. My mother was very, very sick, and I had been taking care of her for a while. And they had been married for 38 years before they divorced. And my father would call me every night at her apartment for a report on her that day. So he was very, very concerned about her, but would never, they never spoke again after the divorce. And at some point when my mother was dying, I explained to him that he would have to either talk to her or write to her or send flowers or do something to make peace with her, because it had been so acrimonious. And I could tell that he had a lot of unsettled business with her and was still very emotionally tied to her. And so we had a phone call one night about this, and he was, you used the perfect word before regarding him, gruff, and hung up on me. He said, I don't need you to tell me what to do, and hung up. And the next day I was in her hospital room, and someone came in with a huge, 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 glorious bouquet of flowers, and they were from him. And the card said, I'm so sorry, Joe. And my mother just looked at it, and at first she didn't know which Joe had sent it, because she knew several. And when I explained that it was Dad, she said, well, he is a sorry soul. And then told me, which comes up later in my book many times, no matter whatever happened, to never, ever, ever divulge her mother's pot roast recipe to him.
So the pot roast recipe.
Yes.
That was
pot
so
roast was very important.
And very important to him, I gather, who had asked for that recipe again and again and again.
And offered me $10,000 cash for it several times.
Did he really?
Yes, he did. It was a crisis of conscience for me, Diane.
By then, Erika, by the time your mother was dying, had your father remarried?
Yes, he had.
But he
married.
Go ahead.
He had been sick with Guillain-Barré syndrome.
Yes.
And ended up marrying his nurse.
I remember talking with him after that had happened. But nevertheless, even though he had married again, he still considered your mother his wife.
That was my feeling. And with my father, as Tracy knows, and anyone who really has studied him or knew him, you could never really tell anything 1,000%. Everything was always contradictory. Everything was always a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But I think reading between the lines, as I did, certainly when I was writing my book, I came to that conclusion that they had still been very, very deeply tied to each other, even in acrimony, as people can be.
Did they separate and divorce because of his philandering, or was it simply after 38 years your mother decided enough was enough?
Well, I think it was everything. I think My mother had tremendous trouble with something happened. She was very hurt by her portrayal, the portrayal of my brother and myself, the whole nature of it, which was this scornful, disaffected, unhappy, griping man with this perfectly normal family being so, so deeply unhappy. And I don't think she ever really recovered from that with him. And the philandering, I think, she was sort of aware of, but she didn't have specifics. And as long as things weren't specific, she could turn her head and deal with it. But at some point, somebody became very specific, and they had many arguments about it. And I think what would have been required of him at that point in order to stay married was to change his behavior. And I don't think he was willing to. I think he wanted to stay married and have his old life back, and that was not going to happen.
Tracy Darity, in writing your biography, Just One Catch, there are many photographs in the book which are really fun to see, but I wonder if you came across Joseph Heller's womanizing.
Oh, certainly. And of course, Eric and I were in weekly and sometimes daily contact when we were both writing our respective books. And so I heard a lot of stories from Erica as well. But yes, there was plenty of evidence of that, including some letters and some court testimonies in the archives at the University of South Carolina, which I went through. So it was all there. One kind of footnote, though, to the Something Happened story, it's fascinating to hear Erica talk about the portrait of her family that she and her mother saw in the book, which is true enough. It is quite autobiographical, obviously. But the other fascinating side of that coin is to look at his rough drafts and the notes he took in preparation for that novel, which I was privileged to do there in the archives, and to see that he spent almost 14 years taking notes and rewriting it. So it's not like this was just one unconscious kind of blurt about his family life.
Right.
It was a very disciplined
right.
project as well, and that's what's odd about it.
But, Erica, he once said, "I don't do kids." So
right.
what was he like as a father?
He was a mixed bag, Diane. He was very self-involved, unless there was something interesting happening with us, and in that case, he was involved in that. And it sounds haphazard, but I think it kind of was. He was primarily, I think, and I think Tracy would agree, he was a writer, and I think writers are working all the time, even if they're at the dinner table or at the movies, or Coney Island having a hot dog.
It's terrible,
and
isn't it?
So I think there was always a preoccupation. You never felt that you really had his full attention, which could be very frustrating, I think, for young children. As I got older, I learned how to get his attention.
Like how?
Well, like being a terrible student, unfortunately. He could sit and look bored in school when he was small and know the answers.
Right.
I didn't know the answers.
I see.
And probably looked bored.
I gather he refused to meet your boyfriends?
Yes, that was sort of an early edict. And I was very, very small at the time. I don't remember how small. But he told me he did not want to meet boyfriends. He did not want to ever have to go to a wedding if I had a wedding. And again, it was the mysterious sum of $10,000 cash, which for him must have had some great meaning. But if I were to get married, to elope, and he would pay me $10,000 in cash.
In Something Happened, he has a chapter called My Daughter's Unhappy, and I wonder how that made you feel.
It made his daughter extremely unhappy. I was devastated. There's no clever way to get around that. I was demolished because of what Tracy said, because my father sat with that day after day, year after year, and knew that I would see it. And it was so, so close to the dynamic that we had. It was verbatim conversations. And the most interesting thing to me about Something Happened was his unwillingness, or he did not see that as his story if you spoke to him about it. He did not consider it autobiographical. That man, Bob Slocum, was not him. And in some way that let him write about us that way. And that was the most interesting part as I got older and older and read it again. His lack of awareness about himself was the most compelling thing about it to me.
How did you ask him why he wrote about you in that way?
Oh, I certainly did. I did, and he said it wasn't you, and what makes you think you're interesting enough to be written about. So, as always, there were Talmudic questions that were unanswerable. There was no real debate. There was no place to go from there. You know, it's very much like the quote that you quoted at the start of your show, when people would ask him, how come you've never written anything as good as Catch-22 again? And he would answer, who has? And he would mean it. But it was also not an answer. It was an end to a discussion.
Is the story about Peter a true one?
Yes.
Tell me that story.
Well, we lived in the Apthorpe, which had a wonderful courtyard, still has a wonderful courtyard. I live there now. And we had a second-floor apartment overlooking the courtyard. And my brother and I sometimes would play down there. And my father would call out the window and say, I want a pizza. And if we didn't feel like getting a pizza, we couldn't get back into the apartment.
You mean he'd lock the door?
He would lock the door, or else if we went in, he would not be very friendly. He wanted a pizza.
Erika Heller, her new book is titled Yosarian Slept Here. When Joseph Heller was dead, the Apthorpe was home, and life was a catch-22. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. As you think about war, Tracy, do you think that Joseph Heller's experiences flying missions over France in August of 44, do you believe they shaped his life in such a way that he had to write Catch-22?
I do, and there was one particular mission which he details in the novel, in which the plane was hit by enemy flak, and he thought they were going down. And the gunner, the tail gunner on that flight, was wounded, and he had to help the young man. So the scene in Catch-22 that keeps being repeated in glimpses, where the young man is saying, I'm cold," and Yossarian feels he's only wounded in a minor way, but we then see the full horror late in the book, and comedy then turns to tragedy. That all actually happened, and Heller felt that day that this is not an abstraction. They're trying to kill me personally. And after that, he wanted to go home. And this, of course, is at the heart of Catch-22.
Erika, how did your dad react after Catch-22 came out?
He anticipated its success in a way that any writer ought to envy, I think. He assumed that people would understand it and would embrace it. And there were people around him who weren't so sure, and it did take a while to get traction, but I think he knew beforehand that he was going to write something that was going to be extraordinary. And there may be many writers who think that, but he knew it. And when it came, he was not surprised. He was very happy. He enjoyed his success as much as anyone I've ever seen. But I don't think he was surprised.
It's interesting, Tracy. He actually tried to keep from getting drafted and then finally wanted to join the Air Force.
He did. The Army lowered, the government lowered the draft age from 21 to 19, and he knew at that point that there was no way he could avoid. And so he enlisted at that point in order to choose his own branch of the service. And he said years later that Catch-22 was not an anti-war novel as he saw it, that he thought after Pearl Harbor there was no choice except to go to war. He thought the war had to be fought. He would never say that we shouldn't have engaged the Nazis. And in later years, a lot of critics said that he backtracked in saying these things. But in fact, from the beginning, he was saying, this is not an anti-war novel. The war was actually good to me.
Interesting that the original title was Catch-18. Why?
That was an arbitrary number in the early drafts that he just picked. He wanted to make fun of military rules and suggest they were all arbitrary, and so he picked an arbitrary number. But he worked on the book so long, over a decade, that that number, 18, was entrenched in his mind, so that when he had to change it at the last minute because Leon Uris was coming out with a book called Mila 18, and his editor said, we can't have two war books with the number 18
in the title.
Bob Gottlieb stepped in. It was devastating because that number had become so fixed in all of their minds.
Bob Gottlieb is totally persuasive. I know that because he was my editor as well. How did your dad react to having to change that name, Erica?
I remember that there was some panic. And my parents would be throwing numbers around together, and 19 didn't sound funny, and 58 sounded too funny, and there were a lot of phone calls, and Bob Gottlieb eventually came up with 22.
And that
22 was it.
That was it. Erica Heller and Tracy Daugherty. We'll take a short break and come back for your calls.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By American Jewish World Service, pursuing global justice through grassroots change at ajws.org. And by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.
I'm the last leaf on the tree.
Tom Waits from his new CD, Bad as Me. Keith Richards joins him on a couple of tracks, including this one. We hear from Tom Waits on the next Fresh Air.
I'm the last leaf on the tree. When the autumn wind blows, they're already gone.
Thank you.
And welcome back. It's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Gaithersburg, Maryland. Good morning, Joan. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I just thought I'd call because my father served on Corsica with, in the same bomb group that Joseph Heller served in. And after he died in 1998, I made a website with all his letters to my mother and her diary during the same period. And I always thought that my dad should have continued his, he started out wanting to, or not wanting to write, but he was a writer and he had things published in his college, you know, literary magazine and stuff like that. And his letters were so awesome and filled with stories as similar to what's in Catch-22. But now I'm kind of glad he went into accounting and didn't continue to write. I might have had the same traumatic childhood, but I did have a lot of, you know, similar stories in my childhood.
Interesting.
He was a Greek-American, grew up in Chicago, and was, you know, beat up for being Greek and had a lot of issues and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it's just, I've always been interested in the book and his life story because of that. The reading the book is just like reading his letters, except that his book is probably more graphic.
Interesting. Tracy.
One of the fascinating things for me is that since writing the book and even during the writing of the book, I heard from a lot of sons of veterans, some of whom served with Joseph Heller. And just a couple of weeks ago, I heard from the son of Doc Marino, who was the real-life model for Doc Danica in the book. And I had suspected, Eric and I actually talked about this and did a little detective work, or tried to. I suspected that Joseph Heller might have gotten a medical discharge early because he didn't fly all the missions he was supposed to fly. We could not prove this. Erica filled the paperwork out and got the government to respond, which is a miracle, and we got his discharge records, and there was nothing unusual. But this man, Doc Marino's son, wrote and said, I think you're right, because my father used to talk about that. He was the doctor in the union.
And he would
sometimes you know, give people breaks.
But so what kind of medical discharge would he have gotten?
What we call PTSD TD now, and what they called shell shock
PTSD.
Then.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks for calling, Joan. Erica, I have a question for you. After Something Happened was published, you actually wrote something in Harper's Magazine that gave your point of view about what your father had written. What did you say in that article, and how did your father react?
My father was very happy that I was being published, I remember. It was a long, long time ago, and I remember more what it wasn't, which was vitriolic. I think I tried to be humorous. It was an issue about families, and I sort of parodied Something Happened a little bit, but the thing I would like to stress here, and I haven't really had the opportunity yet, is that he was an incredibly funny man. It was very, very hard when I talk about a difficult childhood. It was also sort of magical because he had this idiosyncratic wit, which never stopped.
But did you get it?
I eventually did, yes.
Eventually.
It was very hard not to laugh at him.
Yeah.
Pretty much all the time because the wit was so extraordinary, even if it was aimed at someone.
I would think as a child, one perhaps insecure by being put down for one thing or another, that understanding one's parents' humor, especially if it's aimed at someone, as you say, would be difficult.
Well, I think you rise to the occasion.
Hmm.
My father had very funny friends that were in our house a lot, and there was a lot of bantering, and a lot of joking. And I think we learned very early that that was the currency of conversation. And a lot of it we took personally. I can't speak for my brother. And a lot of it I didn't. I know that a lot of it was just about being funny. And it was something that he couldn't help. And I think that comes across in Catch-22, the part of it that I've read so far.
All right, let's go to a caller in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. I'm enjoying the show so much. Joseph Heller was the greatest thing in the world to me when I was in the service. I went in during peacetime, 61 to 63, and I served my last year and a half at Fort Hood, Texas. And I read Catch-22. He had a great guy. I said, you got to read this. He kept me in his book, and I believe he is Yossarian. He kept me somewhat sane so I didn't go AWOL looking at all ridiculous stuff serving in a peacetime army. And what's more than that, he'll always be with me, Erica. Your dad was one of the greatest guys in the entire world, and I'll never forget him.
What about
Thank
that?
You so much.
Thanks so much for calling, Jim. What about that? Is he Yossarian?
Oh, absolutely. And I think we just heard why Catch-22 caught on the way it did. And the notion that he was serving in a peacetime army is interesting, because one of the things that Heller used to say all the time in interviews is, again, this is not an anti-war book. This is in some ways a book about peacetime and when war mentality gets applied to peacetime. And that was something that Heller felt was happening during the 60s.
Here's an email from Mark in Ann Arbor, Michigan, who says, as a huge fan of the novel, I found myself balking at your repeated description of it as an anti-war classic. It is, in my mind, a microcosm of the world and the absurdity of the human endeavor. Did he clearly state it was intended to be anti-war, Tracy?
No, not at all. He would rebuke that notion all the time and again say that the war had to be fought and war is not really the subject. Going back to the notion that his sensibility was formed early on in childhood, the anxieties, the sense that the world is absurd, goes much deeper than war. War is just part of the bigger picture.
All right. Caller in Hickory, North Carolina. Good morning, Scott.
Morning. Yeah, longtime fan of Joseph Heller's. Thoroughly enjoyed all his writings. And one thing that's just always kicked around in the back of my mind is what if any kind of working relationship or shared perspective Joseph Heller might have had with Kurt Vonnegut, who, I mean, they both seem to be obviously deeply affected by World War II from obviously two very different perspectives. And I was wondering if either of you were aware of any kind of relationship they had.
Well, certainly
like
they were.
Answer that.
Yeah, I think Erica should answer it. She was there, but certainly they were also literary kin.
Go
they
ahead.
Were friends.
They were
friends.
Uh-uh.
They both lived in East Hampton at the end of their lives. Kurt also lived in New York sometimes, as did my father. But they had great respect for one another and I think great respect for each other's work. And one of the things somebody keeps asking me since my book came out is what writers were in your life, what famous writers were in your house all the time, and who did you come across? Did you meet this one? Did you meet that one? I found in my experience that writers put together were not always so comfortable liked sharing the spotlight or talking about each other's work. And Kurt and my father, I think, were an exception.
Hmm.
They genuinely enjoyed each other, and they were proud of each other's books and interested, and they laughed a lot.
Is it true, Erica or Tracy, that Kurt Vonnegut was a POW in Dresden while Heller was overhead in a bomber, Tracy?
Oh, over Dresden? I don't believe so, no.
You don't believe
no,
so?
No. They were in the war at the same time, but I don't believe Joseph Heller actually flew over Dresden while Kurt Vonnegut was a prisoner. It's a nice story, but I don't think so.
Okay, that was a question from Ron in Stowe, Ohio. Erica, for you, tell us about the Guillain-Barré syndrome that your dad suffered and left him paralyzed for a time.
Yes. My parents had separated. It was several months after, and he was getting ready one Sunday morning to have brunch with some friends in from out of town, and he noticed that he didn't have the strength to button his shirt when he was getting dressed. And very, very quickly, I think he began to develop a weakness through his whole body and went by ambulance to Mount Sinai Hospital to intensive care. And things had to be ruled out. It was a very complicated process. And within a couple of days, they knew it was a viral infection of the nervous system. And it did leave him paralyzed. He could always speak with some difficulty, but he could speak. But everything else was gone, and he had to eventually relearn sitting up, walking. And he was very, very fiercely dedicated to that. He worked very hard.
Do you have any reason to believe that the separation from your mother played some role in that illness?
I don't really know. I think he was certainly in a state of turmoil. He was firing everybody. He fired his editors. He fired his accountants. He was breaking loose of everything when this happened. So he was in some chaos and turmoil. And I think, really, as I said before, he was going to get divorced, but I don't think either of my parents really wanted that. But it had gotten too far along by then. And so I think maybe he may have had less of a fight in him to ward off something like this. Nobody really was ever able to say why you get it.
It was actually he who filed for divorce from your mother.
Well, he was very angry at that point because my mother wanted him to leave. And I think just financially he wanted things to be settled. And also he was able to get out a lot of his aggression that way by having a divorce. And they actually had a trial. And I think he rather enjoyed the trial, except for paying the lawyers. It was sort of theater for him.
Erica Heller, her new biography of her father. And it's as much autobiography as it is biography. It's titled, Yosarian Slept Here. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And here's a caller on from Miami, Florida. Good morning, Ray.
Oh, good morning. I enjoy your show. I'm an addict as
Thank
far as
you.
Diane Rehm Show is concerned. I was born 1925 in Coney Island, born and raised until age 13 when we came down to Miami Beach. I came down with my folks. And, of course, like many others, Catch-22 was just a kick for me, having been in the service. I wrote a note to Joseph Heller. I don't know how I got his address. Most likely, I wrote it in care of the publisher. And I was astounded and pleased to receive a reply, handwritten note from him. While the show has been on, I was hunting around to find that note, and I wish I did. But I was so gratified by the fact that not only was there a response by a very popular author, but the fact that it was handwritten. It was very touching.
Was that typical, Tracy?
I think so, and Erica can also speak to this, I'm sure. But as she said earlier, no one enjoyed his success more than Joseph Heller. And in fact, some people thought he was being quite unseemly in celebrating how successful he was. Huh. But I think the good side of that was that he was quite attentive to fans and to people who would come talk to him. I mean, late in life, he would be a little cranky with autograph seekers and so on when they disturbed him in public. But I think he valued readers and paid good attention to them.
One last question. In 1997, a letter in the London Times suggested there were striking similarities between Catch-22 and a book published a few years earlier. What about that, Trace?
There was late in Heller's life this charge of plagiarism that another World War II book had similar incidents and characters. Most people looking at the books say that whatever is similar between them is similar to most war books. It's just there's only a limited number of experiences that you can kind of talk about. And the charges vanished and, in fact, only increased Catch-22's popularity.
And, Erica, one last question for you. You have said you had never read Catch-22. Is that still the case?
I'm working on it. I'm up to page 87.
Hurry up.
Which is far. What's the rush? It's farther than I've ever gotten.
Is
and
there?
I plan to finish.
What is the resistance?
What's the catch?
Yeah. What's the resistance on your part?
The resistance is, I think, that once I've read it, it's over. And it's sort of a secret surprise still waiting for me. And I've read everything else of his. So once that's done, he's done. So it's sort of a way to hold on to this a little bit longer, I think.
Erica Heller, her new book about Joseph Heller, her father, is titled Yossarian Slept Here. And Tracy Daugherty, his new biography, is titled Just One Catch. Thank you both.
Thank
so
you.
Much. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cabot Creamery Cooperative, five generations of New England and New York farm families working together to produce naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from Carbonite, automatically backing up computer files for individuals and small businesses worldwide. Learn more at Carbonite.com. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the environmental outlook. Plastic bags, bottles, and other trash are turning the world's oceans into what some call plastic soup. What can be done to save our oceans?